You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 14th of October 2021 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily is brought to you in association with Allianz.
The UK finds yet further ways to test the EU's patience. Alitalia takes off for the last time. And what was the least useful thing you learned at school? I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily in association with Allianz starts now. Hello and welcome to a special live in front of an actual audience, Monocle Daily, coming to you from the Monocle Media Summit in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Marie Leconte and Enrico Franceschini will be here to discuss all the day's big stories, and we'll have further contributions from whichever Monocle staffers fancy muscling their way onto the stage. Stay tuned for the Monocle Daily in association with Allianz on Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Daily. I am Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Marie Leconte, political journalist and author, and Enrico Franceschini, London correspondent for La Repubblica. Hello to you both.
Hi.
Hi.
And as foreshadowed in the introduction, this is a special edition of The Daily, broadcast live from the Monocle Media Summit at the Hyatt Regency Hotel here in London, in front of an actual audience. Let's hear it from you. Yeah, just to confirm to our listeners that we're not making this up. I'm also joined right now by Tom Edwards and Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck. Tyler, first of all, at the end of the Monocle Media Summit, can you sum up what we've learned here today?
Oh my goodness, lots of things. We've learned that you always have to have Peter York come along, not just as a guest, but he just needs to be in the audience as well. And these only work when you've got great participation from people in the room. I think probably what we heard, though, and just the variety of voices, starting with Christine O'Krant, also looking at our guests on stage for your show right now, is just the importance of real global diversity and a mix of real international voices with nice accents as well. And you can comment on that.
I do think it makes a difference. I think, as we're about to demonstrate with Enrico and Marie, the power of accents and what it lends to a program, I think, in terms of just its texture. It makes them nice to listen to, as well as bringing in, hopefully, different perspectives.
I agree, and I just had to say one of the things that I was really struck by sitting in the audience is when somebody has become good at being a broadcaster, how you listen, how you tune in to what they have to say. And for me, hearing Clarissa up here on stage talking about her work, there's a kind of silence around these people when they speak. A good broadcaster, you're so tuned in to what they're saying. And you know, an amazing amount of authority in everything she said. And the other thing is, we must say, we love Peter York, don't we? Because Peter York, you know, he has a phrase for everything. And the notion that content is basically slurry is going to be a phrase I will be using for a long, long time. I hope he's not in the room, because he may kneecap me for that. But I always love hearing Peter. He's so on the button and so knowledgeable about everything he talks about.
I have learned from experience that there is no energy more completely wasted than trying to write a script for an interview plan for Peter York. He's just going to go where he goes, and you're along for the ride. Tom Edwards, what's been the highlight for you so far today? Apart from being here right now, and yes, my exemplary attire.
Well, no, I think, and I'm sure that our panelists on the program will talk about this when you get to it, but it's a restatement of some of these traditional values. We actually kicked off right at the top of the day by talking about the importance of investing in journalism, not just financially, but sort of almost emotionally. It's a human story. And time and again today, all through the summit, we kept coming back to this thing, the primacy of storytelling. And you know, hopefully we'll weave a few more on this daily right now. But the fact that that was underscored from colleagues in broadcast, in print, on the retail side, even when we talked about, you know, the distributions of magazines, there was a humanity to it. It was about investing in the story. And I think I took a great deal of comfort from that.
And if I could just say as well, it's great having someone like Christoph Amend up on stage and Jeremy, because if we listen to, you know, the media from the other side of the Atlantic, even if you listen to the UK media, I mean, there's this downer mentality on the state of print, newspapers, magazines, whatever it is. And then you have someone like Christoph just telling this amazing story of their newspaper and their rise in sold copies. And it just it completely changes the narrative. But, you know, if you want to book a guest, you know, I think lazily on the newsroom floor, well, we'll just, you know, we'll get an analyst in who comes from, you know, one of the big three, and they'll talk about it. And they'll talk about it through an Anglo lens. They're not going to focus on what the French market is doing and what the German market is doing or elsewhere. And I think, if I can say, I think that's one of the things we've really strived to do, not just in the last decade of broadcasting, but the last 15 years of running this business.
Tyler, Andrew, and Tom, thank you all. And we can now resume a more sort of regular Monocle Daily, except for the fact that we're being stared at by people while we do it, and we're standing up.
We are. It's very odd. I don't like it.
and we're also holding microphones like we're about to burst into some sort of harmonized chorus. I mean, the show's young. It could happen. But we will start with a story-making news today. And as those still able to read or hear of anything Brexit-related without dropping abruptly dead with irritation will be aware, the UK is attempting to renegotiate the Northern Ireland Protocol it has agreed with the EU at least once already. This week, Ireland's Deputy Prime Minister, former Taoiseach, of course, Leo Varadkar, has warned anyone else who cares to listen that the UK is a nation which doesn't necessarily keep its word. A masterclass, if Varadkar will forgive the compliment, in British understatement. This is quite fun for us, standing here as an Australian, a French person, and an Italian, getting to discuss whether or not the United Kingdom is a trustworthy country. Marie, given the rich and glorious history of cross-channel rancour, would you like to weigh in on this? Has Albion revealed itself as definitively perfidious?
And what I will say is I think I've actually been quite taken aback by how angry France has been at Britain for the past few months. I think, you know, obviously that really, what was it, today or yesterday, Clément Beaune, the Minister for European Affairs, basically said, yeah, like, effectively, we do not trust Britain. We will try to get the entire EU behind us to just screw them over Christmas. And I think, what was it, about 2 weeks ago, I think France, was it like threatened to blockade all fish and food coming into Britain for Christmas? And it's like, what? Sorry, we're doing what? I think it's fair to say that our relationship, which has been strained many times before, I think is going especially poorly at the moment.
France, of course, has been pretty angry with my own home country recently, but that is over a whole other thing. Just to follow that up quickly, Marie, before I ask Enrico, is there any part, though, really, of the French establishment, the government and media classes, which kind of enjoys a chance to tee off on the British?
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it is not a coincidence that we have elections coming up next year, but which I sort of like, actually, in a way. Of, I think, you know, before an election in Britain, I think, you know, British political parties really enjoy bashing the French. And we do as well. You know, it's a wonderful kind of relationship we have. But so I think it's that. But I do think it's also kind of intense frustration of this sense that, you know, the EU, like EU countries did not want Brexit to happen. Brexit is happening. And it's the fact that it will just not stop happening. You know, and I think the same as, yeah, sort of like British voters as well, I think, have a similar feeling, is the fact that, again, you know, the Northern Irish Protocol, that what will it be next? Is the fact that it is never going to stop. It's just a process that is going to sort of like clamour the EU for the rest of our natural lives.
Enrico, these are really good, fun questions for an Australian to ask. But the United Kingdom, of course, has always prided itself on being the nation of fair play and plain dealing. And there's a certain amount of outrage and anguish notable in some of the coverage of this here in the United Kingdom that anybody could think that the British were not trustworthy. This idea of Britain as an inherently trustworthy country, is this an idea that exists exclusively in the heads of the British?
No, it exists also in the head of Italians, of many people around the world. I mean, we consider Britain the birthplace of the rule of law, which it is. And people come here to form a company. The people come here to have a divorce because they think here the words of tribunals, of courts, matters and stays the same. You can trust it. So, I mean, Britain's word is one of the most important values you have, this country has, not you, because you're Australian, Andrew, but so it's very disappointing. It would be funny if it was not tragic that we are going through this process. I spoke with some people at the European Embassy in London, and they are desperate also because they want this quarrel to end, you know, and on the other end, maybe it will never end, or it may end badly, worse than it is right now.
Well, Murray, on the subject of this ever-ending, though, how invested do you think the rest of the EU still is in this? Like, when this flares up again, despite Brexit having been theoretically got done, when it flares up now, is the reaction from the rest of the EU just, oh, dear God, make it stop?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's kind of the anecdote I always bring up. So in 2018, I think it was, I went to Brussels for a conference about the future of the EU, you know, because every conference in Brussels is about the future of the EU. And, you know, and it was a kind of like one day thing with several panels. And I think so Brexit only got mentioned two or three times. And at the end of the day, I was genuinely quite taken aback, thinking, actually, no, I really thought this was going to be a much bigger topic. And actually talking to people at the drink reception afterwards, they were all like, oh, God, you know, people would not shut up about Brexit. Can we stop talking about the stupid, stupid Britain and them leaving and stuff? And I was like, oh, actually, that's quite interesting. So I think there's not been any appetite to talk about Brexit, you know, from the nation states and I think in Brussels since at least 2018. So the idea that, again, the protocol, you know, Lord Frost arriving and saying, you know, I have new opinions on this, will please absolutely no one.
Well, we're going to move along now to a story concerning Enrico's home nation, because Italy's venerable flag carrier, Alitalia, it did not always enjoy the most glowing of reputations. Many will have heard or sympathised with the joke about how Alitalia's name was actually an acronym, standing for aircraft landing in Turin, all luggage in Amsterdam. It is nevertheless melancholy to consider the prospect of the red, green and white livery taking off for the final time. Today's service from Rome to Cagliari will be Alitalia's last. We're also joined for this item by Tyler Brulé. But Enrico, first of all, could you tell us a bit about where Alitalia exists now in the Italian consciousness? Is it regarded as a totem of great national pride? Will there be a great sadness at the thought of it taking off for the last time?
Well, personally, I am sad. You know, I've flew from Aeroflot in the Soviet times, which was called Aeroflop because it tended to be not very trusted, to the Concorde once, thanks to the generous upbringing, upgrade by British Airways. But I never found a company as good as Alitalia in the best days. You know, they had the most elegant hostesses and stewardess, they had the best food, the glamour of Italian lifestyle in the air. But it also stands in the eyes of Italians and maybe the rest of the world, not only for the acronym, which is not entirely true, and actually it meant always late in takeoffs, always late in arrivals. This was the acronym was supposed to be, but our trains were left. Alitalia was not so late, and it was so good to be on an Alitalia flight in the best of times that you, to quote the George Clooney film, you would be happy to be up in the air for longer than expected. But it also stands for everything that is wrong about Italy, because it was run very badly by the state, by private companies, corruption, bureaucracy, too unionized, too many people doing not doing enough. And so it was a disappointment. It represents the two faces of Italy, the best and the worst.
Well, Tyler, on that subject, and given what Enrico has just said about what was good about Alitalia, and obviously the fact that Alitalia had to work with or riff off one of the most beloved national brands in the world, that of Italy, that people, when they think of Italy, they think mostly good things. Where did it all go wrong?
Well, it doesn't just go down to one CEO. It's not just, you know, one set of governors that were behind it. It's a tragic story, and some of it, and when you talk about two faces, you know, one of the critical issues that surrounds an airline like this one is a face of Rome and a face of Milan. So at a time when we speak of hubs and the importance of hubs, we've seen time and again, unless you're the United States, you know, even Australia can't get away with it. So they were trying to run Rome for all of the obvious reasons, and for all of the right economic reasons, also running Milan. And this is incredibly difficult. You can see across Europe, for example, even Lufthansa struggles up to a point with the power of Munich and the power of Frankfurt to run both of these. So this is, I would say, one of the key issues, a curse of geography in many ways. And then, of course, you know, I always like to have a go at consultants as well, but there's just been, you know, a history of just the wrong advisors in the background. Of course, some politically appointed, some from the private sector. But, I mean, Rick, to your point, it's so true. There was a moment, and I think this is going to be missed, and it's funny, I'm looking at our November cover, And we have Giuponti. Giuponti, of course, one of the most celebrated design icons of the 20th century. And when you look at the amazing Alitalia ticket offices in Rome, in New York, these were masterpieces of architecture. And you know, I have to say that I have no shortage of good ashtrays from the 1960s and cutlery and all kinds of things that I've collected, including posters as well. So I don't give up hope. I mean, the asset is available to purchase. You know, that the name is available. Maybe they're hoping that they're going to make some money off of it. I would love to see someone, you know, ride to the rescue. You know, maybe, I don't know, maybe John Elkann or someone. You know, he's got Ferraris. Maybe he'll be
he's
a brave man.
He's got my newspaper as well.
And he's got your paper as well. So so say hello to John. But it would be very interesting to see if this can have another life, because this new brand that has been cooked up it's not going to resonate. And we'll see. Who knows? I mean, we're in these final hours. Does Air France step in at a point to do something bigger? Because we're talking about a G7 nation here, and we're talking about a major global economy. So I can't see it withering away and only being left to maybe the Germans or the French to come in. Let's see.
Murray, there's a conventional wisdom already abroad here that Alitalia is a victim of Italy's actually very good rail services. Is there an argument that that's the way it should be, that short-haul flights should be giving way more and more to better and better rail services, especially in Europe?
Yes, and I can't exactly remember, but I do get the feeling that France is maybe banning some flights within France. I'm now terrified I'm wrong because I've seen it on air.
There is into one of the airports, only if they can feed connecting long-haul services, so yes.
Yes. Okay. You know, which I think is absolutely the right thing to do. But the problem is that, you know, and especially looking at the UK, I think trains are so expensive here that generally most of the time it is so much cheaper to fly. So no, absolutely. I think, you know, on the longer run, this is, I think, what should happen. Obviously, keep the flights between countries or kind of, you know, between oceans, but from one ocean to the other. But absolutely.
Andrew, I was just going to add though, and we can talk about the airline in a domestic context and getting people across borders. In Europe, but we're talking about a nation which also, when you look at the Italian economy, it does host a few important trade fairs as well. So we were recently in Milan, not doing quite a live show like this, but at the Salone del Mobile, you know, this is, of course, it was its first edition back, so it wasn't as big. But you know, this notion, you know, do you want to fly into Italy always on Delta? Do you always want to be brought in by Emirates? Possibly, but there is this notion of also flying the flag. And I think as we come out of this, you know, COVID era, we move to another time. And one of the great things we see is the competition amongst nations right now. You see countries jockeying for prize position. Where are people going to invest? Where are tourists going to go? If you don't have a flag carrier or something that resembles a flag carrier globally, they may not fly to Sydney again. I'm not sure. But if they can get you as far as Bangkok, if they can fly to the U.S. West Coast, etc., these elements are essential economically and strategically.
In fact, we do have one that can become potentially the new flag carrier. It's called ITA, not a nice name. They want to buy, as you said, the brand. They want to buy the name Alitalia, which has been put on sale for a very high price. They wanted 200 million euros. Now they are offering 50. Let's see what happens there. But it's important to have a national carrier for many reasons, as you said. Maybe Alitalia will have to concentrate on the long flights because, as Maria also said, the railroads are taking over the short ones. We have now very good trains, the fast trains that go as fast. It's not convenient to go to an airport to go from Milan to Rome when you can go from the center of the city to the other center in 3 hours or a little more. And also, we have another national carrier in Italy right now, which is called Ryanair. I flew in the past month from Milan to Bari in the south, and then from Brindisi in the south to Cagliari on Ryanair, which has taken over many of the routes that Alitalia were badly managing. It is going to be impossible to get it back.
And I was just going to add quite quickly, I'd forgotten, I once took the train from Venice to Bologna, and it was actually such a nice train, and I absolutely loved the fact that there was a coffee machine on the train that served me one of the best, like, fresh espressos I have ever had in my life, which was so delightful, and also just, yeah, one of those, like, of course, why not? It's Italy.
just a final thought on that, because I did do a story for Monocle magazine a few years back about riding one of Italy's in many ways exemplary but in other respects insane rail services, and that is the overnight from Milan to Palermo, which is the one where, for reasons surpassing understanding, rather than just get everybody off one train onto a ferry and then onto another train, as would seem sensible, they spend half a day disassembling the train, loading the whole train onto a ferry, and then rebuilding it on the other side. It makes absolutely no sense. That aside, it's a wonderful journey. The only other thing I would suggest Italian Railways urgently need to do is ban people, certainly in the compartment next to mine, from listening to opera on their laptop really loudly, which on the one hand, obviously incredibly irritating, but on the other hand, delightful when a nation conforms to stereotype like that. Is that something that happens a lot, or was I just lucky?
I think you were lucky, but you could have gotten, you know, someone like Italians do, speaking loudly on their phone for 3 hours next to you. Worse than opera, I suppose.
Murray, just a final thought on this. Are there any especially distinctively obnoxious French railway passenger behaviours you have noticed?
I'm trying to think. I'm not sure there is. I would say, to flip the question slightly, I think people eating crisps on British trains is one of the worst things about this country. Like, I once, and I feel like people looked at me like I was mad, I had to cover myself entirely with the massive scarf I had because it was the winter, because someone was eating cheese and onion crisps just opposite me, which I believe to be one of the worst foodstuffs ever invented. And the smell, which was the entire carriage. And actually, that was my moment of going, bloody hell, Britain. Like, come on, pull yourself together.
This is fun. Does anyone else have anything bad they want to say about Britain? Because we're just up here now. We're broadcasting.
Actually, you know,
they can't
going
stop
back
us.
To Brexit, what we were saying before, I'm incredibly sad that what is happening, because I think Britain, it was so important for it, European culture. I mean, it's one of the pillars together with Germany and France. And, you know, to think that we lost it, it's a grave loss for all Europeans. And we have to, you know, remain friends, because it's a contribution that is invaluable.
Well, British culture, I know, is a subject to which we are about to return with our next topic, because this is today's final subject, which is an overhaul of the GCSE syllabus in Wales. Now, do stick with us. This does pick up. Now, among the innovations will be new courses in film, digital media, manufacturing, and engineering, and all perfectly fair enough. What we really want to ask our panel was, what was the most useless subject you ever endured at school, or indeed subsequently? But I do want to start, Marie, on the subject of British culture, which I know, wondrously, you actually studied at school in France.
Yes, we were talking about this before the programme started. So I was obviously taking English lessons at my French high school, but we also had the option of doing a module on English culture. Which I took, and we did things like watch Bridget Jones, the movie, and then talk about what that... Actually, I really remember that really clearly, because we talked about the turkey curry they have on Boxing Day, and actually used that as an example to talk about multiculturalism in Britain. So actually, you know, not entirely useless, but quite fun. So my teacher was convinced for some reason that British people were the best in the world at ads, especially TV ads. So we once spent an hour just watching ads on telly, I think. I'm not sure whether he'd managed to buy a VHS of, like, the best of British ads, or, like, if he just compiled it himself, just watching sort of, you know, ITV or something and taping them all. But yeah, no, so it was not, I mean, you know, I laugh when I think about it, but at the same time, I think it was quite good to learn about another culture as well, that, you know, beyond the language. And in the end, I did move here as well. So, you know, the joke, I think, is squarely on me.
I am now just shuddering to think what a course in Australian culture at a French high school would look like. Enrico, when you think back to your time at school or studying subsequently, was there any one subject which now strikes you as a more or less total waste of your time? Or are you going to stand there and do the whole, no, all education is good in and of itself thing?
What I regret is that I could not do it back then because I was in school a long time ago, what it's possible to do now that I saw my son doing in school in Britain. So that at one point in your education, if you are not very good in a subject or you don't particularly love it or you don't think you're going to use it for your university studies, you can drop it or spend less time on it, while I had to, you know, keep doing math and physics and chemistry, which I hated it, and I was terrible at it. So this is my big regret. I wish we had a class in English culture like you did. I mean, we had classes of course in languages. I was very bad in English too. I'm still not very good, as you can hear. But you know, I improved a bit. Then when I moved to America after school, and so I married an American. And that helped me to, you know, manage a little better. And then I moved to Russia. I married a Russian, and my Russian became not too bad.
I feel like we're missing part of the story there somewhere, Enrico.
Yeah, we were talking about school. You're right.
Because a thought that occurs to me, Murray, and it's something I have pulled a total 180-degree skid on, one of those rare instances of a complete change of mind, and it does tie into a lot of what's been spoken about here today, was that I signed up for media studies in my last year at high school in Sydney, assuming, indeed knowing, that this was an absolute DOS, something you could comfortably phone in an hour a week and claim credit for out of all proportion to the work you had actually put into it. But given the way the media landscape has changed since then, I now kind of think that teaching people media studies is about the most important thing we could be doing, and from a very early age.
Oh, I actually agree. But I think the problem I have with that, especially now over the past sort of like 10 years, is that I think especially digital culture changes so fast that how do you actually teach it? So I studied journalism at university in from 2009 to 2012. And actually, you know, the lecturers, we had quite a lot of modules on, you know, this is how you do a blog. Or, you know, once, you know, sign up to a Twitter account and post a tweet. And it's like, yeah, well, bless you, but we're all 19. Like, we've been doing this for years. We do this better than you do. So I'm not, I do think, yeah, taking this seriously for a moment, I do think there's a challenge in that. That is actually something that should be taught, but how do you find enough grown-ups, basically? You know, enough people who were not necessarily digital natives, but who get it, who grow, you know, got a better sense of it to actually teach it to those kids. So a good idea, I think, in theory, but not. I'm just not entirely sure how you make it happen, yeah, without it turning into, you know, some 35-year-old going, and now, kids, you know, this is TikTok.
Enrico, what do you think? Is there a way that media literacy can be taught, ideally from more experienced practitioners to younger generations, without turning into that teacher who's rolled up their jacket sleeves and turned their chair around and is sitting down cross-legged and addressing them as kids?
I think there is. What they are doing, what you mentioned before, it's very important. I think that, for instance, even from a very early age, to suggest, propose, help children even to, for example, do their own newspaper, a digital newspaper, would be great, because it's you learn a lot of things doing graphics, design, writing, drawing, taking photographs. So this is an idea. On the other hand, I must confess that to teach all these new subjects, let's say, it's very important and interesting. But school, particularly at an early age, but even in you know, high school, I think it should give children the basics, students the basics to, you know, read books, do math if you're good at that, philosophy, history, geography, all these things are so important, and learn to write, learn to read well, Latin, which is in this country mostly done now in private schools. In Italy, it was done in my age in all the public schools, all the state schools, for free. I thought to give the basis, and then when you go to university, you can develop what you want.
And that, I think, is where we will have to leave today's special live edition of the Monocle Daily. A big thanks to our panelists today, Enrico Francascini and Murray LeConte. Also to our audience, also to Tom Edwards, Tyler Brille, and Andrew Tuck, who joined us earlier. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Rabello and researched by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. The drinks are through the door next to the stage, which I think is going to be that one. Don't push or shove. There's plenty for everybody. I am Andrew Muller here in London. Thank you for listening. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for being here.
For more than 130 years, Allianz has expanded its business and stretched its brand in new and innovative ways. And while the world looks very different today than it did back in 1890, one truth remains. Allianz's passion for securing people's lives and giving them courage for what's ahead, no matter what. The world is a better place when people have more courage than fear, especially in uncertain times. People seek stability and confidence. By supporting each other and sharing resources across the world, Allianz has helped people to overcome their fears and look to the future with hope and with real confidence. Marie-Do Harbour-Sansonneau is the Brand and Communication Director of Allianz France. Marie-Do Harbour-Sansonneau, it's great to talk with you. Does social equity and community feature in the impact Allianz wants to make?
Social equity is 100% part of our purpose, and we believe we can drive positive social change worldwide, be it only because we have 150,000 employees who are all driven by the same desire and who love volunteering in the various programs that we offer. So when it comes to social impact, Allianz has three great priorities: caring for the next generation, supporting youth employability, and also contributing to a better social inclusion of those with a disability. How do we do this? Well, concretely, because we're an insurer, we have products designed specifically to include vulnerable populations who would be excluded from certain services otherwise. So for example, in France, we devised a specific micro car insurance for populations who are jobless and who are being coached to get back to work. And we also develop a special payment protection insurance specifically for people with diabetes, helping them access the credit they need. So, of course, on top of these products, we have giving programs addressing social inequity, and many Allianz entities have foundations dedicated to education or employability or integrating refugees. At Allianz France, we have a foundation which is dedicated to health. And so we've been supporting medical research for over 35 years now, awarding a yearly prize. And in COVID times, we made an exceptional 1 million euro contribution to the famous Pasteur Institute to accelerate research on the virus.
Marie-Do Harbour-Sansonneau, Brand and Communication Director of Allianz France, on unlocking, building and maintaining confidence today and tomorrow. With Allianz, you can take confidence in tomorrow. Allianz, behind you for what's ahead.